This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up on today's program, more clashes in West Papua as protesters challenge the establishment of six new provinces. Solomon Islands leaders hit the road to calm regional angst about their security pact with China. And challenging times for the Hawaiian shirt, with fashion brands urged to face up to its cultural significance.
It's kind of sickening that the mainland has kind of taken this thing that actually is very integrated into our daily lives here in Hawaii and kind of made them like tacky pieces for parties.
All that and more on the show. I'm Nick Fogarty. Great to have your company this morning. First, though, Indonesian police are using water cannons in an attempt to shut down protests in West Papua over an administrative shake-up to the region. Thousands of West Papuans have taken to the streets this week in opposition to Jakarta's decision to establish six new provinces in West Papua. While the government is promising more development, many Papuans believe the changes will tighten its grip over the region. Joining me now is Rosa Moywind, a Papuan activist in Jayapura. Good morning, Rosa.
Good morning, Nick.
Rosa, why have these proposed new districts in West Papua been so controversial?
First thing is because there was no proper process of decision-making. So it's all the decisions taken only by Jakarta, by the government in Jakarta, without involving West Papuan people to decide whether they want to have a new provinces or they want to have some more proper evaluation of the special autonomy law. So that's been a constant rejection since 2020. Like almost every month, people march on the street and protesting against this policy until recently, just yesterday, when we saw it on the media. Yeah.
And as you say, we've seen videos on social media of police using water cannons to disperse protesters, and tear gas was also reportedly used. Are you concerned by the tactics that police are deploying?
Yes, definitely, because under the Indonesian national constitution, freedom of expression, assembly is guaranteed. It means that any citizens of this country are allowed to express their opinion, even though it's opposing the government policy. But there should be a more democratic space for the West Papuan as well to express that. But unfortunately, instead of letting the protesters peacefully express their aspiration and rejections, local police here, they deployed almost like more than 1,000 officers on the street to stop people, and using all these militarized equipment, because, you know, like water cannon and other tear gas, this is very, very violent. Because from my concern, I've been monitoring on the ground during the protest, and I knew that most of the old protesters, they are very disciplined, non-violently, not attacking, not bring any harm things or weapon or anything like rock or stones. They just very, very disciplined on there and maintaining non-violent discipline when they march and rallies. But police came and just attacked them without negotiation, but just directly attack and then throw the tear gas and also water cannon. And I'm very worried about the condition, health condition of this protester, especially for them who get that the water cannon, because it's very close. It's not long distance water cannon. It's just like 5-10 meters. So you can imagine their condition right now, which we can't see any support from any organizations at the moment, because it's difficult to get them. They are very worried about their security as well.
And apart from the water cannons and the tear gas, the protests have been peaceful so far, relatively peaceful, but are you worried that things could step up and violence, real violence could happen?
Actually, from my analysis and many of us, the human rights groups here, we are worried about the policies of Jakarta to use more militaristic approach by using more, sending more troops and facing West Papuan rather than open democratic space or, negotiation or dialogue, something like that. So then the people of West Papua can deliver their message. But with these policies of bringing more troops and military to the field, it's actually worrying because it will cause more kind of trying to attract people to use violence. But I believe that the West Papuan, we are not violent people. We like to talk and negotiate with the government. So I think it depends on how government will approach the situation in West Papua right now. If they use military approach, that will create more violence and conflict.
I'm speaking to Rosa Moywind, who's a Papuan activist in Jayapura. Rosa, can you tell me a bit more about how people are feeling? And do you think these protests will continue while these changes to the district remain on the table?
Definitely. This protest will be continued, and it's organized by Papuan People's Petition because they have organized a signature petition since 2020 to reject the, all the policies from Jakarta. So I think this will continue until the government in Jakarta stop all the process of policies for West Papua and open a space for West Papuan to deliver their voice. So I think it will be continue, and it's still kind of a key issue at the moment being spoken by people, even on the street. People just talk about that. So, yeah.
And some of West Papua's Pacific neighbours, including especially Vanuatu, have been very vocal in support of West Papua traditionally, but others have been less so. Do you feel like your struggle has many allies in the Pacific region?
I think the leaders in the Pacific, they made a really good support and actions. Recently, we knew that the elders, Pacific elders, they sent an open letter and, their position to ask for the Indonesian government to look at the human rights violations but in West Papua, but also, to find more progressive action to solve the conflict in West Papua. So I think the support is still there. And we hope that through the Melanesian Spearhead Group and also Pacific Island Forum, I think with this human rights atrocity situations at the moment, I believe that Pacific leaders still on their commitment to support human rights in West Papua, but also to open more progressive communication and dialogue with the Indonesian government in terms of to find a solution, a better solution for West Papua.
Well, we'll wait and see what happens in the coming weeks and months. Thanks very much for joining us, Rosa.
Thank you, Nick.
That's Rosa Moywind, a Papuan activist in Jayapura.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The Solomon Islands Foreign Minister Jeremiah Manele and Police Minister Anthony Veke are continuing their tour of the Pacific, trying to calm anxieties about the security pact they've struck with China. Earlier this week, the two ministers addressed a gathering of Pacific leaders and senior officials at the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat in Suva to brief them about the security agreement. It comes as anxiety grows in Canberra about a possible visit to Honiara by China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi. Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts joins us with the latest. Stephen, what do we know about this briefing on the security agreement which was held at the PIF Secretariat in Suva?
Well, at this stage, there's been no formal release or communique issued by the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat or from any of the countries within the meeting that was held earlier this week in Suva. We know a few things about what happens. We know for a fact that there was essentially a grab bag of senior officials, a small number of Pacific Island leaders, and a few foreign ministers at the meeting. So it was a very mixed crowd. Most of them, we're told, were effectively Zooming in. They were connecting remotely, whilst there were a few others who were actually in the room, including the Solomon Islands Foreign Minister and Police Minister, as well as two senior officials or a number of senior officials from Australia and New Zealand. Now, in this meeting, we know that the Foreign Minister in particular ran through why he believes and why the government of Solomon Islands believes that there are no reasons for Pacific Island nations to be concerned about the agreement, reiterating that it was a matter of sovereignty for Solomon Islands and not the concern of regional bodies, and also repeating that there will be no military base or installation built by China under the pact. What do we know about the response? Well, there are slightly different characterizations as to what the response was, but one thing is clear. Almost all the countries in the room or their representatives reiterated that they respected Solomon Islands' sovereignty on this point, but then many of them, I'm told almost all of them, also raised a number of concerns, sometimes not in very strong language, sometimes rather elliptically, but still raising concerns about, for example, the lack of consultation from Solomon Islands or the lack of transparency around this agreement, which still hasn't been made public. It's not clear if or when that will occur. Now, in terms of what the outcome is, look, it's difficult to say at this stage. If the main aim was to try and bump this off the PIF leaders' meeting agenda, that's due to happen potentially next month, then it may not have been successful. I'm told that a number of people in the room, a number of representatives, made it clear that they did want to see a face-to-face discussion on this topic at the leaders' forum. So if that was the aim of this briefing, then it probably wasn't successful. And I spoke earlier to Tess Newton-Kane. She is the project lead with the Pacific Hub at the Griffith Asia Institute. And she says it's unsurprising that Pacific Island countries would want to have a discussion on this pact when leaders do eventually meet.
I think that he possibly was hoping to keep it off the formal agenda for the PIF meeting, bearing in mind that we still don't know when that's going to take place. From what we've seen so far, I'm not sure how successful he will be in that regard. I think that for a number of leaders, they would be looking for the opportunity to have the sorts of conversations that PIF lends itself to as the most appropriate forum to discuss something like this, which has obviously caused a fair amount of concern and possibly anxiety across the region.
Pacific researcher Tess Newton-Kane there. So, Stephen, does this mean that Australia and New Zealand are going to be able to use PIF to try and pile up pressure on Solomon Islands over the pact?
No, I don't think it necessarily means that the successful effort to really pile on the pressure here. There are limits, I think, here to what the Pacific Islands Forum and Pacific Island countries are willing to do. Australia and New Zealand have been pressing, behind closed doors largely, but pressing Pacific Island nations to raise their concerns both privately and publicly with the government of Solomon Islands and to make public statements expressing their disquiet. They've only had mixed success in doing that. While a small number of Pacific Island nations have voiced concerns publicly, many have issued far more cautious statements in public, and all have stressed the sovereignty of Solomon Islands. In other words, saying even if they were a bit uneasy, or even if they were suggesting they're a bit uneasy about what's going on, they're not comfortable with the prospect of publicly trying to berate Solomon Islands or trying to convince it to withdraw this decision. Again, this is a really delicate issue. Tess Newton-Cain says, whilst it's clear that Pacific Island leaders do want to discuss this issue at the forum leaders meeting, again, that's probably going to be next month, it's not at all clear that there's an appetite for them to go further and, for example, to censure Solomon Islands, let alone contemplating a step such as trying to push it out of the forum. Those options, she says, are simply not on the table. Let's take a listen to what she had to say on this point.
Based on what we've seen previously, and particularly the trauma that was inflicted in the time when Fiji was excluded from the forum further to the coup in 2006, I don't get the sense that there's any appetite among the regional leadership to be using PIF as a means of censuring individual members. Sogavare is a well-established leader. He has a number of very deep personal relationships. Australia needs to realise that generally the methodology that PIF is used for is to establish and maintain consensus. I don't think that anybody would be looking to try and isolate Sogavare over this.
And what's the latest on the possible visit to Honiara by Wang Yi? Is it likely to happen?
Well, we don't know for certain that this visit will definitely happen, although the ABC has spoken to one senior Solomon Island government source who said that plans for the visit were underway. The word on the street in Honiara is that it could well happen towards the end of next week. But again, that is not confirmed. If it is at the end of next week, of course, there are some pretty interesting political ramifications in Australia, because that's only a day or two before people go to the polls. And there are already murmurs in the coalition side of politics here in Australia that this might be done with an eye to hobbling the coalition's election chances. Now, whether that's true or not, the optics of Wang Yi, the foreign minister, visiting Solomon Islands and potentially, if this trip does go ahead, signing a series of additional MOUs or agreements will definitely be striking and will absolutely stir further anxiety in Canberra about China's efforts to cement not just its commercial but also its security ties with Solomon Islands. Now, the other suggestion that's doing the rounds in Canberra is that if Wang Yi does go, then he may well take the opportunity to formally sign in a ceremony the deeply contentious security pact, which has been at the core of this enormous controversy both in Australia and regionally over the last month or so. Now, the two countries have already apparently agreed to it, so this is largely going to be a symbolic gesture, but it's a pretty powerful sort of symbolism because, again, this is going to be the foreign minister of China being welcomed into Honiara on the eve of an election in Australia. Not only that, probably as part of a broader regional Pacific tour, which will once again highlight the fact that China is making some substantial strides in the region, despite the fact that in other countries around the Pacific, its attempts to really build up influence have stalled somewhat.
Thanks, Stephen. The ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts.
Hold the front page!
Time for the news headlines now with Faith McCallay. Good morning, Faith.
Good morning, Nick, and good morning to everyone listening.
First to Papua New Guinea and some devastating news. The Deputy Prime Minister, Sam Bazil, has died in a car accident. What are the details?
Yes, in a police statement posted by Post Courier, Deputy Prime Minister Sam Bazil has succumbed to the injuries he sustained in a vehicle collision. Mr. Bazil was in a critical condition at the hospital awaiting for medevac, but after hours of attempting to revive him, he was pronounced clinically dead. Reports say that there was another vehicle involved and three other injured person has been transported at the Bulolo Health Facility to seek medical attention.
Thoughts with Mr. Bazil's family there, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that on the program coming up. Now to New Caledonia, where the country is looking to turn to a more environmentally friendly nickel production.
Yes, New Caledonia's energy transition project will be presenting a plan to power the country's nickel factories using 50% renewable renewable energy by the year 2030. This comes in an attempt to make greener and cleaner nickel in order to stand out in the global market, Radio New Zealand reports. Indonesia is the world's top producer of nickel, followed by the Philippines, while New Caledonia is the fifth biggest. And according to the Direction of the Mines and New Caledonian Energy, New Caledonia is one of the highest CO2 transmitters per population and per year in the world, because the three nickel factories in the territory are powered by charcoal and fuel.
And now in Western Australia, a Tongan fruit picker has been told that he will be jailed after he was caught in a video beating a cat.
Yes, 28-year-old Max Locchetti was working on a farming property in Perth when he picked up a small black cat and repeatedly hit it with a 2-meter pole. A footage was played in Perth Magistrates Court where another person can be heard laughing in the background while this is happening. And Mr. Locchetti pleaded guilty to one charge of animal cruelty when he appeared in court on Wednesday via video link from Hakea prison. He will be sentenced and is also due to be back in court next week.
Thanks very much, Faith.
Thank you for having me.
Our reporter Faith McCarley there with the latest news headlines from around the Pacific.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
In Papua New Guinea, all eyes will be on how the next government will act on a Commission of Inquiry report into a controversial $1.2 billion Union Bank of Switzerland loan. Political analysts say the UBS report will be a hot topic when candidates start campaigning, but it's uncertain whether the talk will translate into real action. And based on past precedent, the prospect of action looks slim. Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby.
Honourable Minister,
unilaterally decided Minister, to commit the people of Papua New Guinea.
Honourable Minister,
a ruckus in Parliament over the contents of the UBS report. Fingers pointing in one direction with personal attacks on the characters of MPs named in the report.
It was the former Prime Minister unilaterally. Tok Blongem.
Honourable Minister, if you want to use the point of order to do explanation, I will not allow for it.
Political analysts say the finger-pointing will be a key feature when campaigning rolls out later this month.
Peter O'Neill, the former Prime Minister, is anticipating that he will come back and form government. And there would be some of his opponents, people who are campaigning also to form their own government. They might want to frame this particular UBS loan and use it as a campaign message for their political parties.
Patrick Kaiku, a political scientist at the University of Papua New Guinea, says the report's contents will be scrutinized and debated on the campaign trail.
This particular report here, it makes very damning allegations about, the cabinet not knowing the text of memorandums of understanding that were developed by, UBS, personnel. And then they were just told to sign on or to agree with that particular memorandum of, that memo that was circulated in cabinet. So if this is how our government or our cabinet administers affairs of state on behalf of Papua New Guineans, it really is very detrimental for our national security.
The war of words have already begun with outspoken Member of Parliament and former Justice Minister Brian Cramer using Parliament privileges to speak about the inquiry.
Facilitated by Oil Search for its own gain, using our government and a Prime Minister at the time, and that money then channeled elsewhere. So the question I guess we need to know is, one, whether we can recover it. If not, then we need to focus on who we can hold accountable. That's in the UBS, that's the former Prime Minister, and all those people that were architects of this scheme that resulted in 1 billion kina being lost by our people.
Mr. Cramer told Parliament action needs to be taken by the PNG government to get back what was lost by PNG.
When an ordinary Papua New Guinean on the street goes into a Chinese store and tries to steal an oxen palm because he's hungry, he is completely assaulted and belted when that Chinese man calls some police to come and arrest him for stealing an oxen palm. And yet, at the highest levels, people can steal 900 million or billions and not a single thing happens to them. When the effect of that theft results in our mothers, our kids dying for lack of medicine, for lack of medical equipment, and yet we continue to sit here like hypocrites and talk about issues about our country and making it better. Mr. Speaker, someone needs to go to jail. And that's all. Thank you.
Former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill will be working extra hard during the elections to muster the numbers to form government. He told Parliament he accepts the report but will defend it in court.
I will subject myself to the recommendations that the report has suggested. I am very happy to defend myself, whether at ITAC or in the courts. So I have no issues with that, Mr. Speaker. I am responsible to the people of Papua New Guinea.
One of the recommendations of the report is to have the country's newly established Independent Commission Against Corruption prosecute those responsible. UPNG's Patrick Kaiku says the ICAC must do its job.
ICAC now should act on some of this evidence that has been generated, and immediately the ICAC should be called on now to prosecute the former Prime Minister, who was very instrumental in negotiating and in facilitating this deal. The former Secretary for Treasury, Mr. Dairivele. The names are very explicit. They're stated here very clearly.
But Mr. Kaiku says PNG commissions of inquiries haven't gotten the follow-through they deserve. Most of them are collecting dust in Parliament.
We have a very low bar indeed in terms of the expectations that anything will come out of this, inquiry, this report. It is very voluminous. The magnitude, there are two parts to this report, the final report. Part one is more than 2,000 words. Part two is more than 2,000 words. Somebody has to sit down and simplify all of this into just workable information that can be used by people who are advocating for implementation of these recommendations to be made.
University of Papua New Guinea political scientist Patrick Kaiku ending that report from Bethany Harriman in Port Moresby. Well, they come in green, yellow, brown, and any other shade you can think of. Yes, corals certainly give colour to our oceans. And with about one-third of the world's corals currently under threat of extinction due to climate change, researchers have discovered a lost species of coral which was hidden for more than 50 years. Dubrovka Volodar spoke to David Djaskovic from the School of Molecular and Life Sciences at Curtin University about it.
So the main finding is we looked at a coral that had a cosmopolitan range within the Indo-Pacific. So it means it was found all the way from the Red Sea, all across Australia, down the Horn of Africa, all the way through Asia, up to Japan, and all the way across to Hawaii, and as far south as Tasmania in Australia. And this was originally known as one species, which was Plesiastra versipora. And then using our methods, we were actually able to find a second species, a cryptic species, that occurs north of the Tropic of Capricorn in Australia. And then the true Plesiastra versipora is only found south of the Tropic of Capricorn in Australia, making it endemic to the area, so only found in that area. So what it means is there's been basically, over the last 200 years, we've only thought there's only one species, well, over the last 50 years anyway. And so by finding a new coral species that's kind of hidden within, and when I say cryptic, it's a bit different to cryptic as in with fish. So a cryptic fish is something that's maybe hiding under a rock or under a reef and it's hard to see. When we talk about cryptic species in corals, it means that if you're scuba diving, snorkeling or swimming and you were to look at the two species, both Versipora and Peroni, you wouldn't actually be able to tell them apart just by looking at them. So it was the genetics that actually separated them. And that's an interesting finding. So it's really interesting to see that they're actually that original Versipora doesn't actually have such a wide range as it does, and one's restricted to tropical locations and the other to temperate.
You just spoke about that for observers, you know, if we're scuba diving or snorkeling, we can't really differentiate those two species. Can you just, for our listeners, describe how they look like?
Basically, both Plesiastra versipora and Peroni, they can form little submassive colonies, so almost like a clenched fist. Sometimes you can get boulder-like colonies, but then sometimes they encrust, so they kind of just grow along the surface and are kind of like thin plates. But they can have different colours as well. So the same species can be a vibrant green, it can be a vibrant yellow, it can be a brown or pale yellow colour. Especially under ledges or in shaded areas, they can have really beautiful, vibrant colours. But telling the two apart is almost near impossible unless we look at the actual skeleton itself, which is what we do a lot of in coral taxonomy.
Mm-hmm. And that's how you found out?
Yeah, so that's kind of the traditional method that's been used for 200 years. So we used that method, but genetics was one of the strongest indicators. That's the way all taxonomy is moving in all different animals and plants, and we're finding a lot of things that look morphologically the same. Genetics is able to split it up.
How do you research genetics in corals? How does that look like?
So basically, we scuba dive or snorkel for samples to begin with. We'll use a hammer and chisel, and we'll break a little bit of the colony off. We always want to leave a little bit of the colony left over so that can flourish and grow back. And then from there, what we do is we take a little chunk and we put that in 100% ethanol, and we take another fragment which we bleach. And with that fragment that's been in ethanol, in the lab we'll undergo a certain process or workflow where we'll get the DNA out, we'll then sequence and then do bioinformatics. So we're working with quite a bit of data, trying to look at the barcode behind the actual species.
Sounds fascinating. Now, I think about a third of the world's corals are currently under threat of extinction due to climate change. What are the implications of your findings?
First of all, it shows that we found a species hidden within, and that's really important because with corals disappearing currently, and this goes for a lot of species, if we're not going out there and looking what else is there, what other cryptic species exist, we can get this term silent extinctions. So things disappear before we even have the ability to discover them. And by finding this split, it means, especially in Western Australia or the East Coast, because there are now two species, that's really important in marine park conservation. So it means that these areas where there's a transition zone where both species might be occurring, or, you know, one area might have one species and another area might have the other, you know, they're areas that need to be protected, and we need to start, you know, the marine park managers would consider tougher management protocols in those areas.
What can the general public do?
Well, it starts at home, right? Making the changes at home, you know, going solar, being more green, and making a difference does start at home. But I think communicating and educating to your kids that we can make little small changes at home.
That was David Jaskovic talking to Dubravka Volador. If you're fond of dressing up, either for a party or just for a day out in the sunshine, chances are you have an Aloha shirt somewhere in your dresser. Hawaiian shirts with their bright colours and palm tree prints are so iconic in the world of fashion that even high-end brands like Gucci and All Saints sell them. But as Faith McCullough reports, the shirts have a controversial past, and despite their popularity, many people are unaware of their cultural significance.
It all started with a $1,000 Hawaiian shirt. It was a blue shirt with palm trees and clouds printed on it and the words Los Angeles stamped across the front. When Hassan Piker, a popular Twitch streamer, wore the Gucci shirt at Coachella, some Hawaiians took offense, including podcaster and activist Anuhan Hapali.
I started out with a tweet that said, like, rich people will buy literally the most ugly $1,000 Gucci shirt or designer shirt rather than supporting a Hawaiian brand.
Anuhea said that while the shirts are not a closed cultural practice, it is still a formal wear in Hawaii.
It's kind of sickening that the mainland has kind of taken this thing that actually is very integrated into our daily lives here in Hawaii and kind of made them like tacky pieces for parties.
The origin of these bright summery garments has been hotly contested, with fashion and cultural experts unable to agree on who invented the shirt. Washington State University Emeritus Professor Linda Arthur Bradley says the concept of aloha shirt comes from a combination of different cultures that influence Hawaii.
You have the Western-styled shape of the garment. You have the Japanese fabric. You got the Chinese tailors. You got the Filipino way of wearing a shirt. And then the last part is the development of Hawaiian prints.
Anhean Hipali says they've seen people, especially on the internet, try to deny that non-Hawaiian brands designing these shirts are appropriative just because the first creators weren't of Hawaiian ancestry.
How is somebody going to look at this designer brand kind of like appropriating something, tie it back to the origins of the shirt, but not realize that Hawaiians were not empowered at the time to be indulging in their culture, creating new things?
When they received backlash on the Twitter thread, they said the reaction was expected, especially because people are not aware of its cultural significance.
If you don't have that cultural understanding of colonialism and gentrification, of course you would be like, well, it's just a shirt.
Anuhea describes Hawaii as being oppressed into a corner of tourism because people just see it as a place for a vacation. They say that's why it's important to have a non-tourist-centered way to represent their culture. And supporting Hawaiian businesses is one way to do that.
I just feel like if you want to wear one, buy Hawaiian. That's like what I think. Because then you're actively contributing to Hawaiians like money, like giving business to Hawaiian people, which is already like very important.
Now, Anuhea says Hawaiian designers and artists have entered a space of cultural renaissance.
I would say that Hawaiians have reclaimed the shirt through just creating. Like, there have been so many brands that have come up in the past few years, in the past 10 years, that are just so beautiful and completely challenge this tacky idea of this dad shirt or Hawaiian shirt.
One of these brands that emerged was Sig Zane, that had the aim to educate and share what they knew about their culture through their clothing. Creative director Kuha O'Zane said what separates them from a typical aloha shirt is that their products are artworks.
Each one of these aloha shirts that we have a story embedded within the design that share a little bit more about place and educate a little bit more about this place that we call home, which is Hawaii.
And with aloha shirts continue to be a staple piece of fashion all over the world, he said it is important to support where the aesthetic came from.
I think it's important to be able to support them because they're the people that are continually evolving this Hawaiian aesthetic that we have.
He said it's great that aloha shirts are being designed by big luxury brands too, because it gives the shirt a bigger platform, but representation still matters.
I think that whenever they're inspired by Hawaiian design or inspired by Hawaii in general, I think it's important for them to be able to reach out to some of these smaller designers and maybe offer a collaboration or even offer an opportunity to be able to share some of these artist stories on their larger platforms.
Kuha also said that this is because the people of Hawaii are the ones who experience the sceneries that inspire the artworks in these shirts.
Because if you were to buy art from an artist, you would want to buy art from an artist that would be in Hawaii rather than art from an artist that is in any other place in the world.
And for tourists that want to support Hawaiian businesses, he says they should know that there are multiple perspectives on the one simple action of buying local.
You're supporting the ideals that this company stands for, and then also maybe some of the nonprofits that this company gives back to, as well as the families that are on payroll for these companies.
Kua'o Zane ending that report by Faith McCallay. Well, the Pacific Ocean is full of weird and wonderful creatures, but one marine microbe found in the pristine waters of South Australia could be a key ingredient in nutritional supplements, medicines, biofuels, and animal-free meat. Australian researchers say the marine microbes known as thraustochytrids can be used in the industrial production of plant-based meals. Dr. Manish Puri is an associate professor in medical biology at Flinders University, and he spoke to the ABC's Marion Farr about their find.
The most important thing for which these microbes they got, I would call
they came into limelight is basically their ability to produce a very long chain polyunsaturated fatty acids. And as I said before, because those fatty acids are generally found in fish oil, and that is one of the reasons that why fish is being consumed, because since these microbes, they can produce, so there's no, to draw a comparison, so people started looking for something which can be, I would call as a replaced from a fish oil to a microbial oil, because these microbes, they can be grown in a contained environment, right? So, which is more sustainable, more healthy way of growing, and which is more environment friendly. So those were the traits which these microbes have that made them quite unique in their, I would call as a selection for producing such high value molecules.
What sort of products could that oil be used in?
They can be used for producing omega-3 fatty acid, like DHA is the signature molecule, and EPA, that's another molecule. And then there is a docosapentaenoic, which is a third molecule. In addition to that, these microbes, they are good in terms of their use in aquaculture setting as well. And most importantly, I would call as the products which are available from these, they are suitable for vegetarians. And recently what we found that they can also be used for producing animal-free meats as well.
So when it comes to, I guess, producing this microbe on or these microbes on a commercial scale, what does that sort of look like, and what makes it more sustainable than farming fish or catching fish, for example?
To produce a 1 ton of fish oil versus a 1 ton of oil from these microbes, it is a little bit, I would call as dearer, but the fish is no longer sustainable. That is one aspect. And second aspect is there are environmental concerns as well. To scale up these organisms at industrial scale, it is much, much easier. And the type of infrastructure which we need, that is partly is existing and partly federal government is looking forward to supporting it. So there is a initiative at the federal level that they are supporting advanced manufacturing projects. And to grow this organism at industrial scale, that falls into that category.
Mm. Now, I believe that this microbe has been found in the ocean around South Australia, but would there be potential for this to become an industry in the Pacific?
Oh, definitely, because there are some... So we are there is a huge interest in I would call as in Southeast Asia and in a Pacific region as well. So because as I said before, that these microbes, they are found in a marine ecosystem. Yeah, it is only that you need to have a set way of extracting these microbes, and if you can really come out with a formulation in which these microbes, they can grow well, and then you can really have a technology which can be scaled up in an industrial setup, and then you can produce wonderful molecules from these microbes. So I don't see that why there won't be any industry in the future in the Pacific region as well.
So these particular microbes, are they found in a particular part of the ocean, or are they just sort of anywhere in the water?
There is a variation in terms of the lipid profile, depending on where the microbes have been found. Yeah. So because this is what we have found. We did collection from various places. We published literature we published some papers in the media. Yeah. So when I'm saying media, that means in scientific journals. There is a change in the fat profile, I won't go into the technical side of the things, but I will label it as a fact. So that basically changes if they have been taken up from the south of Australia versus western part of Australia versus north of Australia. So we did some a comparative study, and that is what we found, that their fatty acid profile that changes when you source it from a different location.
Flinders University Associate Professor Dr. Munish Puri speaking there to Marion Farr. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 3 p.m. PNG time with Jordan Fennell. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next, which I'm sure will include plenty of coverage of Australia's upcoming election set for May 21st. And if you'd like to see more about the election, you can always watch the latest news on ABC Australia. You'll find our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. I'm Nick Fogarty. Thanks for your company.